I said yesterday that these lectures were going to be disconnected, but different topics. That's going to be slightly more true than I anticipated yesterday, because I managed to become very confused about all sorts of things in the course of talking to people, especially Greg Moore yesterday afternoon. So I thought I'd go back, retreat to things I in principle are meant to know more about than physicists. And so the only really safe ground I got beneath my feet was algebraic topology. So I decided I would tell you about algebraic topology. You see, part of my terms of reference when I was invited to give these lectures was to say a bit about K-theory and its relations to cohomology and to non-commutative geometry. So I'm going to embark on that enterprise, and at the moment that's this lecture and the next one are meant to be kind of about algebraic topology, K-theory, and to some extent non-commutative geometry. But I'm going to begin right at the beginning with telling you how I feel you should look at algebraic topology. So we're interested in spaces, first of all from the point of view of homotopy theory. And we're interested in associating to them algebraic invariants. Now, the first idea that will probably come into one's head when one does that is that when you have a space, the most obvious invariants it has are homotopy groups. You look at spheres of various dimensions, and you consider the maps of spheres into the space, and you classify them up to homotopy. And they form groups, one for each dimension of sphere. And they seem obvious algebraic topological invariants of spaces. And the first kind of thing you learn in algebraic topology is that that's not the right road to go down. One reason it's not the right road to go down is the fact that you can't go down it. That is to say, there's no simply connected manifold for which the homotopy groups are known, not one. And so...
Point.
Okay, so there's one. Well, yes. So there's one.
That's an anomaly.
But, I mean, the big unsolved problem in the subject is to calculate the homotopy groups of spheres. Of course, a lot's known about them. But that isn't really the reason why that isn't. There are actually more fundamental reasons why that somehow isn't the right road to go down. Somehow, and perhaps that will emerge a little bit from the kind of thing I'm going to say. Now, way back it was discovered that the way to go down, or at least one way to go down, which is fruitful, is the root of homology. Inside a space you have cycles, some kinds of submanifolds or whatever, of various dimensions, and you can classify them up to homology, or as one probably nowadays thinks more commonly, cobordism. Now, I'm not going to say too much about that. I'm going to assume you more or less know about that. And even I'm going to talk about cohomology. So we're going to, given a space, we're going to consider functions on the cycles in it of various dimensions and make them into a cochain complex. So one of the first big realizations in algebraic topology is that when you're studying spaces X, the natural thing to associate to them, or a natural thing to associate to them, which is amazingly robust, is a cochain complex. So this is a sequence of groups, CK of X, where these things are the functions on cycles of dimension, on submanifolds or whatever, of dimension K in the space, with some kind of coefficients in some abelian group which one can choose. And I'm only going to be interested in choosing either the integers or the real numbers. Now, you can go from here to here in an enormous number of different ways. there are check cochains and singular cochains, and you can take triangulations of X and make simplicial cochains. And if this is a manifold and we're working with real coefficients, we can take smooth differential forms. All of these are, in a certain sense, equivalent. And that is somehow the amazing observation that underlies a great part of classical algebraic topology. So let me at least explain in what sense they're meant to be more or less equivalent. You see, supposing you take a space, you might make, let's work first of all, say, with integer coefficients. We might consider, say, make some chain complex of singular cochains. We might make one of, say, check cochains for the same space. Now, in what sense are they meant to be equivalent? Well, of course, we can make homomorphisms between them, assign to everything here the chain there of the same dimension, and we'd like these things have, so I should have said, this is meant to be a sequence of abelian groups with an operator which are called D, which raises dimension by one. D on anything tells you what the function did on the boundary of the thing you put in. So we have maps like this which commute with the differential, that taking the boundary here, the co-boundary here, goes to taking the co-boundary there. Now, we call these maps chain homotopic if a cycle under the two different maps goes to cycles which differ, which are homologous. And the way to formalize that is you say you consider maps, really sequences of maps like this, and you identify two of them if they are, as one says, co-chain homologous. In other words, you identify F with anything of the form X plus, write it the way a physicist would, DH anticommutator, where H is something that takes things to things of one lower dimension. That would be an equivalence between two kinds of maps, which obviously will preserve cohomology classes. Anticommutator, DH plus HB. I thought physicists all knew that. So we can associate to a space a cochain complex. We have morphisms between these things, and if we identify morphisms by this relation of cochain homotopy, so this is something, well, come back to that in a moment, then we associate to a space a canonically defined object, in the sense that any two different ways of doing it are going to give us things which are isomorphic in this sense. So we associate to a space this very, very robust algebraic object, a cochain complex, which can be defined in lots and lots of different ways. And cochain complexes, of course, have cohomology. We define HK of X as the kernel of D on CK over the image of the D that goes into CK. And these things are well-defined abelian groups, because relations like this induce isomorphisms of such things. Well, I'm more or less... But when you take whatever models, however models you make, whatever models you use for your cochains with given coefficients, they will always be isomorphic, and in fact canonically isomorphic in this sense. There will always exist such Fs, and any two Fs will be cochain homotopic. They'll be related by this relationship. Yeah, well, if we get into sort of serious pathology of horn spheres and Hawaiian earrings and things, yes, indeed, that's right. But I'm interested in the spaces that algebraic topologists talk about, which are kind of manifolds and things made out of manifolds by a finite amount of sticking together and cutting and chopping and things. Now, I don't want to say too much about that, in that I'm assuming you more or less know that spaces have cohomology groups. and that they're defined in this way. All I wanted to do was emphasize the robustness of the construction. You see, the important thing about this construction is it takes spaces into an additive category. So these things form an additive category. That means that whereas if you look at maps from spaces from X to Y, or even homotopy classes of maps, they just form a set. When you go over here to these cochain complexes, the maps are things which can naturally be added. You have an abelian group of these cochain maps up to chain homotopy equivalence. So we're taking a category where maps can't be added to a category where maps can be added. And in a certain sense, that's the most basic thing that we're doing. Let me now just put in one side remark, which is going to be important later. I said we could do all this taking cochains with various kinds of coefficients, integer coefficients, real coefficients, or so on. Now, the cochain complex with integer coefficients is the one, clearly, which contains most information. You get the real one simply by tensoring with the real numbers. You forget information. Now, the moment you decide that objects like this are good objects to study, then you look around you and you find there are places in which cochain complexes arise, where sometimes they arise over the real numbers, and there aren't very obvious ways of finding integer ones, and sometimes there aren't any integer ones which give rise to them. Now, as that's going to be, that may well be important, you see, in string theory, where we're interested in whether, say, the charge of a D-brain is something defined in integer homology, or whether it should really be regarded as some other kind of object, maybe a K-theory object. So I'd like to first, right at this point, tell you the obvious examples of where you get things that have that don't have integer bases. You see, supposing X is a Lie group G, then we could be looking at the Drahm cohomology. We could look at the differential forms on G. So this is one of the many models we could make for the cochain complex of G with real coefficients. Now, inside this, we could look at the ones which are left invariant under translation in the group. A differential form on the group which is invariant under left translation is completely determined by what it does at the identity element. So it's a function, it's a multilinear alternating function on the Lie algebra of the group. So we can identify this thing with the alternating multilinear functions on the Lie algebra of the group. This is meant to be the Lie algebra of G. Now, of course, if G happened to be a compact Lie group, then one, because cohomology is homotopy invariant, and because one could average, one would know that this chain complex would be yet another one of these things which is chain homotopy equivalent to this and would calculate this, the homology of the group. But this is, the differential on here is just something one makes out of the Lie algebra. And for any Lie algebra, one can consider these multilinear alternating things. And they will give rise to cohomology groups. In other words, this thing is an object in this category of cochain complexes, which is associated to a Lie algebra, which, if the Lie algebra happened to come from a compact group, would have calculated the cohomology of the group. But nevertheless, this is something we can make for a Lie algebra. And what you notice at once is that there's no sign inside it of any kind of integer ones. You see, if we were looking inside here, we could talk about differential forms with integer periods. But if we just have a Lie algebra, there's no such integral basis in sight. And in fact, there is no integral basis in sight. And if we don't have a compact Lie group, this is not... there isn't any this is not an equivalence of homology. For example, supposing we were to take the Lie algebra to be the Lie algebra GLNR, the Lie algebra of the real general linear group, then the cohomology of the alternating forms, the so-called Lie algebra cohomology, this is not isomorphic to the cohomology of the group GLNR. It is isomorphic, in fact, to the cohomology of GLNC, the homogeneous space over GLNR, as it happens in that case. But and this does have integer elements. I mean, you could talk about things with integral periods here, but they have no special geometric significance in terms of that Lie algebra. Right, but that's not the cohomology. Oh, only for a semi-simple. But that natural basis for developing algebra would be only for very special classes of things, like, say, let's say, for example, a semi-simple group. For example, to take an example that might be dear to the heart of string theorists, supposing you take for G the Lie algebra of vector fields on the circle. A thing whose one-dimensional central extension is the Virasoro algebra, then you can make the cohomology of this, and you know that it has an interesting class in dimension 2, which is the central charge in string theory when you consider this. That central charge is something which doesn't, well, the fascinating thing is that there are integrality properties connected with that which are connected with moduli spaces of Riemann surfaces. But there's no natural integral there's no sense in which the central charge is integral or not integral in terms of the Lie algebra of this diffeomorphism group. Well, why did I emphasize that? Well, one of my themes is going to be non-commutative geometry. That's a program mainly associated with the name of Kohn, where one wants to generalize the idea of a smooth manifold in a way that might be helpful in string theory. In fact, I'll try to argue definitely is relevant in string theory, where one says that you can encode a smooth manifold X as a commutative ring, the ring of C infinity functions on the manifold, and one then can say, well, suppose we have something a bit more general, supposing we had a non-commutative ring. One could try to interpret that non-commutative ring as corresponding to something a bit more general than a smooth manifold, but something which did have geometrical significance. If one wanted to do that, one would try to recapture from the non-commutative ring geometrical invariance. So, for example, one might like to recapture from this cohomology groups. And it's very important that as soon as you make the ring non-commutative, you can recapture from it integral homology groups by the methods of cyclic cohomology invented by Kohn. But one gets here another example of a chain complex arising which doesn't have any natural integral structure. And that comes directly from this principle. You see, if you want to associate.
Graham, I think you messed up. You want to say capture the real homology groups.
Yeah, but it doesn't have an integral basis. Sorry, did I say it wrong way around? How do we try to associate a cochain complex or cohomology to a commutative ring in such a way that if it comes by this process, we recapture the cohomology of the manifold? Well, you see, the thing that you can make out of this is you could certainly make the matrices of size n by n over C infinity of X. Now, if you're a physicist, you think of this, and this is a Lie algebra. These are matrices whose values are C infinity functions. This is the Lie algebra of the n-dimensional, the GLN gauge group over the manifold X. Now this has Lie algebra, so take this to be your Lie algebra. Let's call that Gn. This is something we could make for any ring, not necessarily commutative. We can take n by n matrices over any ring. We will always have this cohomology. We take the cohomology of this for large n, as this n tends to infinity, and that's essentially what's called the cyclic cohomology in the sense of Kohn. Strictly speaking, the cyclic cohomology is the primitive elements in that, but it's essentially the same information as the Lie algebra cohomology of this thing. You see, so it's something which goes immediately from a ring, a commutative ring, to a non-commutative ring. In the case of the commutative ring, it's a long story, but what it encodes is precisely the cohomology of this. It's yet another way of constructing a cochain complex equivalent to the cochain complex of differential forms. But although it works for any non-commutative ring, it doesn't have an integral basis when you go to the non-commutative category. Well, so let me now stop that digression and go in a slightly different direction. I said that the essential thing we do when we start going from spaces to homology is we make it possible for ourselves to add maps between things. So let's just think about that in a completely sort of first principles way. So suppose we have our space X and we like to make the category of spaces a bit bigger so that we can add maps between spaces. Well, so let's take the same object but try and adjoin more maps to the category so that we can add. Well, one of the natural things to do then, if we want to have this generalized notion of a map between X and Y, is to associate to X not just a map, but the optimal thing, if we're going to be able to add, is some finite formal sum like this, where the ni's are integers and the yi's are points of Y. Supposing you started trying to think about maps of this kind between spaces. You see, instead of associating to X a single point, we associate an integer linear combination. But clearly these things could be added, so we would then have gone to an additive category. But what does this really mean? Let's say this is an element in, let's call it F of Y, which is the free abelian group. You can make this into a topological abelian group in a fairly obvious way, so that the Y sits inside it as a topological subspace, Y regarded as just the things 1 times Y plus no other things. So this will give us, in fact, a topological group of maps between X and Y. And of course these things will extend, if you had such a map, it would extend to an additive map, a homomorphism, from f of x to f of y. So we could pass from the space to the free abelian group on the space and consider additive maps like that. They would be the same as many valued maps in that sense. Now I claim going from x to f of x is exactly the same as going, it's exactly equivalent to going from x to its cochain complex. But I'd like to I'd like to say that in a slightly more geometrical way. I think people who are not professional algebraic topologists, and even people who are professional algebraic topologists, find this space, the free abelian group on a space, somewhat repellent. And I think if you're a quantum field theorist, you really shouldn't find it repellent. So let me say a word about that. You see, supposing X were a manifold, and you were interested in studying, say, free charge bosons on X. So, free So this would lead to some Hilbert space of states of free charged bosons on X. Now, when you have a Hilbert space which represents some quantum system, and you want to know what the underlying classical system is, the classical configuration space, what do you do? Well, among the operators on this that represent observables, you try and find a maximum commuting family of operators, and they form a commutative algebra, and the spectrum of that algebra, the homomorphisms of it into the complex numbers, are the classicals. Well, if you choose that maximal so that the things which commute with it are abelian, then the spectrum of that algebra, its homomorphisms into the complex numbers, should be the underlying classical space. In fact, the Hilbert space should be the L2 functions on that space of characters. But supposing you do that in this situation, what's the maximal set of commuting observables? Well, you see, the obvious thing that you have acting on this space is the charge operator, the current operator, if you think in terms of the Lie algebra, the group of all maps, smooth maps, from X into the circle. This acts on H. That's a commutative group, and it acts. But what are the characters of this group? Characters of this group are the homomorphisms of this into the circle group. Now, if you this is almost a vector space in that this is almost the same as the real valued functions. The characters are essentially the distributions on X, except that we want distributions of total mass integral in order to get a homomorphism into the circle. So you can split up this, and that forms a maximal commutative algebra acting on this. You can think of this thing then as a continuous integral over some characters of this group, whichever characters arise. Now, of course, in field theory, you don't see smeared out objects, distributions of charge. What you see is charges at a particular point. In quantum field theory, it's very basic that you see point particles. You don't see kind of muddles. And the characters of this group which arise in this space are the characters of the following kind. They're characters which take the function phi to things like this, sigma phi of xi to the ni of finite products, just as I should write them. This is phi of x is a complex number of modulus 1. So the characters that you see are the ones which correspond to integer, finite integer combinations of points. And this space can be realized precisely as L2 functions on this space f of x. So that's meant to be why you shouldn't mind thinking about f of x. I want to emphasize that for several reasons, in that one of my themes is going to be that although I think in quantum field theory one meets a lot of infinite dimensional manifolds and wants to integrate over them, make L2 spaces of them and so on, nevertheless, the infinite dimensional things that arise always arise as increasing unions of finite dimensional things, compact things, in fact, of increasing dimension. In fact, this was Planck's first observation, I think, when he studied black body radiation, that you only have a finite number of states less than any level, and that they grow like the number of eigenvalues, for instance, of the Laplacian on a finite dimensional manifold whose dimension, however, grows with the energy level. And you see, this is precisely the sort of thing you see, and it's a very typical thing in quantum field theory. This space of formal combinations is an increasing union of symmetric products of the manifold, finite dimensional manifolds. Well, now, this going from X to this space encodes homology completely. I said we don't know the homotopy groups of anything, but actually we do know the homotopy groups of this thing, because the homotopy, see, this is not a simply connected manifold, as I was saying before. This is some horrible space, if you think of it just as a space. But one does have the following theorem, that this is canonically the homology of X with integer coefficients. And one has this so-called Dole-Thom theorem. Sorry? I'll tell you some other time. you take... If you considered only finite length expressions of a given length, it has the quotient topology of a product of copies of X. And then you take the union of those. Well, you can also define cohomology the same way. There's a dual statement. You see, this would be the... this is the homotopy classes of maps. So this notation means homotopy classes of maps of X into something. And what is this thing? It's the free object on an I-dimensional sphere. So if you want to think about this, you see, these are... Well, I'll leave that. That's a companion theorem to that one up there. So I wanted to mention this because I want you to have the idea that the homology of a space is at least the homotopy classes of maps of X into something. Now, what do you lose when you go from a space to its cohomology? Well, obviously a lot of things, but the main property that homology has, which you might or might not want, is stability in the sense of algebraic topology. Stability is has an enormous number of meanings, but the meaning it has in stable homotopy theory is the following. One thing we can do with a space is suspend it. I'm mostly interested in compact space. I mean, my space is X, unlike my space is FX, which is sort of abstract auxiliary constructs. I always think of as being compact spaces, or sometimes locally compact spaces. Now, the moment you have something like a locally compact manifold, you know there are two kinds of cohomology you can associate to it. You could consider all differential forms, or you could consider differential forms with compact support. Now, I'm going to be interested essentially always in the case where we study the differential forms with compact support. And if you want to think of that more geometrically, think of that as replacing the space by its one-point compactification. In other words, the cohomology with compact supports of a space X is the same thing as the cohomology of X union a point at infinity. This is for a locally compact space. This is the one-point compactification. Strictly speaking, modulo infinity, but don't worry about the modulo the point at infinity. So it's essentially the cohomology of the one-point compactification. Now, stability is a property that cohomology essentially doesn't see the difference between a space and its thickenings, its suspensions. If you take X and you replace it by X cross a Euclidean space of dimension n, and then you take the one-point compactification of that, then the cohomology with any kind of coefficients essentially doesn't change. It just shifts up and down. So this space is in the trade called the n-fold suspension. It just shifts up and down. So we don't see the difference between a space and a space kind of thickened by adding lots of transverse directions which we compactify. So think of this as, you see, think of X as sitting inside X cross Rn as X cross 0. Supposing we consider differential forms on here which vanish when you go more than a certain finite distance away from x, so these things are sort of peaked around x, then the cochain complex you'll get out of this is just the same as the cochain complex you'll get out of this shifted along by n in dimension. So we have this thing. X is compact in this, yes. Well, if I put compact there, it doesn't need to be compact. But think of X as compact. So we have this property that up to suspension, we don't. This operation of suspension doesn't really affect the homology. So spaces which become the same after you suspend them a certain number of times are not going to be distinguishable. In fact, in cohomology, even more is true. Supposing we have a vector bundle on X, supposing this is a real oriented vector bundle, that means, say, of dimension n. So that means at each point of X I have a fiber, E sub X, which is a vector space isomorphic to Rn. Then I can put X inside E as a zero section. In other words, think of these things as changing from point to point. And the same thing is still true. I can say that H Hi of X is isomorphic to Hi plus N of E. So the fact that the auxiliary directions we added move from point to point doesn't matter. This is what's called the Tom isomorphism theorem. And if you think of it in terms of Durham cohomology and differential forms, then the map that goes from here to here, well, what does it do? If you have a differential form representing something on X, you can, of course, just pull it back to a neighborhood of X inside this bundle. It will still be an I-dimensional form in the neighborhood. We then multiply it by an n-dimensional Gaussian form along the normal directions, along the fiber directions. We multiply those things together. If we had a closed form, we'll get a closed form of dimension n greater, and this gives you an isomorphism of cohomology. I think, again, that's a very important thing to bear in mind if you're thinking of the way cohomology, and as we'll see in a moment, K-theory, arise in quantum field theory, and even more in string theory, because, for instance, in string theory, one of the most basic things that one thinks about is regarding X as sitting inside its own loop space, as a finite dimensional manifold sitting inside an infinite dimensional manifold. And, of course, strings are meant to be mostly very small, so they're concentrated in a small tubular neighborhood of X inside the loop space. And we should be thinking in terms of these iterated thickenings of a space. You see, you have X sitting inside its loop space. As we activate more and more Fourier modes of the loops, we're really looking at an increasing sequence of vector bundles on X inside the loop space. So that's the picture I want you, the application which I'm going to want to be making of this. Now, I'd like now to work from the other end. So I told you from one point of view how we got homology by thinking of adding maps in this rather brutal way. Well, there's another. Once we see that this gives us this kind of isomorphism under suspension, we could work from the other end and say, let's try and make the optimal additive category you can put the homotopy category of spaces into, where you simply identify things which become the same when they're suspended. So instead of allowing to add maps, let's talk about the stable homotopy category. So again, we're considering compact spaces X and Y, and we want a notion of stable map. So what is a stable map? Well, a stable map is a map from X cross Rn, a proper map, to Y cross Rn. Proper means that as you go out to infinity in X, the image goes out to infinity in Y. So more or less by definition, it's a map which, if you like, you can forget about proper if you say it extends continuously to the one-point compactification. So we consider maps which extend to the one-point compactification continuously. These things we classify up to homotopy and we call them stable maps. You see, obviously any map from X to Y gives us one of these things, but we have more. Stable maps can certainly be added, of course, because, you see, supposing you have a map like this, then one of the basic things is, imagine you have X that way and Rn that way, and you have some map of that into something. Well, you see, Rn being contractible, we can push and pull any way we like in this. So we could just take a little disk in Rn cross X, and we could deform this map so that everything outside that cylinder shot off to infinity. So we could always assume when we had one of these maps that it was only interesting in a little tube like that, and everything outside that little tube mapped to the point at infinity in the target. Well, that means you can add such maps, because you see, if you have one of these maps and another one, well, we can move the first one so that it's concentrated in that little cylinder and takes everything to infinity outside that. We can move the second so that it's concentrated in this little cylinder and takes everything to infinity outside that. Then the maps don't interfere. We can just take the union of the two maps. And clearly that's well defined up to homotopy, because wherever we put these two disks in Rn, we can deform one continuously to the other. So this gives us an abelian group of stable maps. Now, this is in fact well known to be the, so to speak, universal additive category that you can put spaces into. In this category, we have beautiful, we have a map from spaces to the stable category of spaces. The morphisms become abelian groups, and any functor with that property, I mean, it takes spaces to additive things, factorizes through this process. I'd like to tell you just one construction which is very important. It's a map from the one-point compactification of this to the one-point compactification of that.
For some n.
For some n, yes. You identify them as n gets bigger and bigger. But for some finite n. For each n we have such a space of maps, but if we go from n to n plus 1, the space of maps at level n is contained in the space of maps of level n plus 1 by just making it the identity on the extra direction, and then we just take the union as n increases. So we have this increasing, you see, we're kind of thickening up the possibility of defining maps by letting the maps be defined in transverse, potential transverse directions. In fact, that's what I did here, you see. In fact, I quickly changed my ground. I said all we wanted was a map which took the one-point compactification to one-point compactification. So it could take points in here to infinity. In fact, when I did this movement, I pushed everything outside to infinity. But I want to say just very quickly something which is in a sense well known to every algebraic topologist, but I've never ever seen it written down, and it's one of the basic things. That this category, stable category, objects have dual objects. Supposing you take a compact space X, and supposing we embed X, we choose an embedding of X in a large dimensional Euclidean space. Just choose any one you like. Any two will be homotopic if n is large enough. I mean homotopic through embeddings. Then what can we do? Let U of X be what I'll call a tubular neighborhood. Open. Of X in Rn. So this is contained in this. Tubular neighborhood would really only be right if it were a compact manifold, and then I can actually take a cube. But this might have some bad singularities. I want it just to be an open neighborhood which would retract, of which X is a deformation retract, as one says. So just if you forget, this is homotopy equivalent to this. It's just a kind of thickening up inside the larger space. Then I claim, X and the one-point compactification of this are dual in the following sense. That there's a good map from X cross U X. I think I'll just put plus to indicate the one-point compactification, because it's a bit shorter, to Rn plus, which is an n-dimensional sphere, and also a nice map back the other way. You see, in an additive category, when are two objects dual? Well, you have the, as it were, a basic one-dimensional object, usually the ground field or something. We're thinking of that as a sphere, because we're in this category, we have this operation of suspending, which we're not very interested in. So we don't regard this as interestingly different from a point. So a duality would be a map of this cross this to a point, and similarly a map from a point to this cross this, such that two obvious compositions are the identity. Perhaps a better way to say it is this: if you give these maps, you'll get a map from X into the space of maps from U. Perhaps let's do it the other way around. It's true both ways around. U X plus into the space of maps from X into a sphere. And what these maps do, and this is just a formal triviality, is induce a homotopy equivalence between this and this for sufficiently large n. So each of these spaces, it's meant to be symmetrical between the two spaces, each of these spaces is meant to be homotopy equivalent to the maps of the other into a large dimensional sphere. Let me just tell you what these two maps are, and then you can, in general, you know, the picture would be two things are dual in an additive category. If you have a map from X tensor Y to the field, and a map from the field to X tensor Y, such that the two maps, X goes to X tensor Y, tensor X goes to X, such that that's the identity, and similarly the composition beginning with Y is the identity, then it's a formal triviality that each is the maps of the other into K. Well, these maps are meant to obviously have those properties. I'll just tell you the maps. Which one should I tell you first? It's very easy. We will map this way. Right. Spaces, but I've made spaces into an additive category by taking these stable maps, so I can now add maps. So these things are objects between which the morphisms form abelian groups. So that gets us into the position where we can talk about bilinear maps or whatever. And the product is a tensor product. This is just meant to be writing this in a notation more familiar for additive categories, where Y is UX plus. And I'm writing the base field, so to speak, for this. This is kind of the unit object of the category. You see, if we take X cross Rn, that's just suspending it, and we're regarding that as not interestingly different. So we think of Rn as the trivial object, and the point object in this category. But let me just tell you the two maps. First of all, this one, I think, the bottom one. If you take a point psi in Rn, you take it to, well, psi and pi psi, where I said this was a homotopy equivalent, so let's choose an inverse homotopy equivalent, a projection back of this onto this. That obviously doesn't extend to the one-point compactification continuously. This is just the d-thickening which collapses u back onto x. So we take that to that if or infinity if psi is not in ux. And you see that's a continuous map from the sphere to this. And the map going the other way, we take x psi to psi minus x. You see, x is contained in Rn, psi is contained in Rn, so they're two vectors. We can subtract them and get a vector in Rn. We want to go into the one-point compactification. So we need to now do something a little bit slightly cunning. Let's assume that Ux contains the epsilon neighborhood for some small epsilon of x. So anything that's within epsilon of a point of x is inside this open neighborhood. And let's define rho from Rn to Rn union infinity by being homotopic to the identity and such that rho of the outside, rho of psi equals infinity if so take the identity map of Rn and introduce a sort of radial pushing out which goes faster and faster so that at distance epsilon you get to infinity. So this is just a continuous deformation of the identity map from the sphere to the sphere. And I apply that here by given two points. Well, we're going to take them to infinity unless they're within epsilon of each other. And so, for instance, you see, if you were to fix this, what does this do? If you fix x, then all points in the neighborhood of it, any psi there, they're being mapped over the whole of the sphere. And you get to infinity as soon as you get out to distance epsilon. So that's the duality in this category.
So is it non-degenerate?
Yeah, this is a non-degenerate duality in the sense that these triple compositions x to x tends to y tends to x to x is homotopic to the identity, just trivially, and similarly the other way around. So it induces homotopy equivalences between each and the maps of the other into a large sphere. The composition, sorry, which composition? No, the composition will be a map from the sphere to the sphere, and as you would expect, it should be equal to the, it should have degree equal to the Euler number of x. That's a very simple exercise. You see, how many times, what is the, well, leave that to you as an exercise. Just, so, the surprising thing is that we've now made two approximations to the homotopy category of spaces. We've said spaces went into the stable category. I mean, stable spaces means spaces and stable maps. And this goes into cochain complexes. Now, one of the remarkable things of algebraic topology is that you might think that going from here to here is not doing so very much, whereas going from here to here is radically losing information. But the strange thing is that that's not true. This map is an equivalence, over the rational numbers, or the real numbers, or anything where you can divide by integers. In other words, if you consider the stable maps up to homotopy from x to y, and you look at the corresponding maps of cochain complexes, well, rationally, the cochain complex contains no information but its cohomology. So you go to the homomorphisms from H star of Y with rational, let's do it with real coefficients, well, true rationally, to H star of XQ. This is an abelian group, so we can tensor that with Q, and this is an isomorphism. So this is the same as this rationally. Okay. But I'm just going to speak for about 5 more minutes, and then I'll continue this tomorrow, because what we now want to do is say, nevertheless, it's interesting in between here and here. You see, whether you want to distinguish, see, in a certain sense, this is pretty close to this. We've just allowed this thickening. But nevertheless, we want to put in here K-theory in between these two things. So a new category of spaces. And I'd like to motivate that in two ways. Again, so to speak, from the two angles that I gave you on homology. I should change blackboards occasionally. So now we come to K-theory. So this is really just a preview of what I'm hoping to say tomorrow. And tomorrow I also want to go more into what will happen if we try to go from spaces to non-commutative spaces and to loop spaces and things like that. If we have, again, X, a compact space, then we can consider vector X, the vector bundles on X, finite dimensional complex vector bundles on X. Now, it's rather important that these naturally form a topological space. It's clear that it would make sense to talk about, if you had a parameter space, you could have a continuously varying family of vector bundles. But to make a long story short, for instance, if you have n-dimensional bundles, you can think of the maps, any n-dimensional vector bundle is pulled back by a map of X into the Grassmannian of all capital N. So if I took vector NX, this is, should be homotopy equivalent to the space of all n-dimensional subspaces of some infinite dimensional vector space. You can pull back any vector bundle from the family of all n-dimensional subspaces of any infinite dimensional space you like. So this is the union of this for all capital N. Now, you define K of X, the group, you probably all know, which is K north of X, as the, now these things can be added, so this is a semigroup under the sum. You add vector bundles fiberwise, and we can make K of X by considering formal differences of vector bundles and identifying let's first of all make a semigroup of isomorphism classes of vector bundles and then formally introduce negatives, and then we'll get a group. So this is what's called the Grothendieck group of the isomorphism classes of vector bundles, but that's the same as the homotopy classes of this space. Now, we would like to, however, do a little bit better. We'd like to talk, you see, we made this out of formal differences of vector bundles. Grothendieck group just means you take pairs of things and you think of them as a difference, one minus the other, so you identify two pairs if you add on the same to each object of the pair. So that's just a purely algebraic thing. But it would be nicer to introduce a larger space of virtual vector bundles, so things which were like the difference between two vector bundles. I'm going to do that, but I'll explain the definition of it. So I'll just write that as virtual X. So this would be like introducing negative dimensional ones. I'll try and explain that in my next lecture. However, I'd also like to put beside it another space, which is meant to, I should say, going from X to the vector bundles on X is something that makes very good sense for a non-commutative ring. You see, if you go from X to the C infinity functions on X, and then go to an arbitrary non-commutative ring, I'll explain this next time, a vector bundle can be recaptured on X is the same thing as a so-called finitely generated projective module over this ring. So these objects are things which you read off very simply indeed from this. In fact, you see, we can say that vec n of X is just the maps of X into the rank n projections in C infinity. You see, think of the fiber as the image. This is just the Grassmannian of n-dimensional subspaces of this. But that's the same thing as the rank n projections in the matrices, infinity by infinity matrices over the ring C infinity of X. You see, so given the ring, you make the n by n, you make the large matrices over it, look at n-dimensional projection operators on that. Tautologically, that's the same as maps of X into this. This is, I was right the first time, wasn't I? Cn, to infinity, sorry. Trying to say things too fast. Let me rub that out, because that's... this space of rank n projections in C infinity, this space is just the Grassmannian of n-dimensional subspaces of C infinity. I said we can think of n-dimensional vector bundles as maps of X into this Grassmannian, but such a map is the same thing as a rank n projection in this. We can now replace this by any ring we like, commutative or otherwise. We can make the matrix algebra and take the projections in it. So this is a space which we immediately have for any commutative ring. And so K-theory is something which goes immediately from the commutative to the non-commutative category. And in its nature, it's something which is defined integrally. It's not vector bundles are honest objects. We don't want to take real linear combinations of them. We a vector bundle has a rank at each point, and a projective module has a rank, and so on. It's an integral kind of thing, K-theory, in its very nature. Now, going from the other side, and this is meant to be where we're meant to get a bit closer to string theory, remember I said in homology we replaced x by f of x, the free abelian group on x. Now, there's a corresponding slightly finer object which you meet in K-theory, and the difference between homology and K-theory is the difference between this thing and the thing I'm about to tell you. So, if you wanted to recapture x from its C-infinity functions, you would look at the homomorphisms from the C-infinity functions into C, the ring homomorphisms. And, of course, it's well known that the only such homomorphisms are evaluation at a point of x. And so you recapture x from the ring as the set of such homomorphisms, the so-called spectrum of this ring. But it's natural to look at spec n of C infinity of x, which, spec n of x, let's say, as the homomorphisms of algebras from the C infinity, I just wanted a space, so let's take continuous functions at this point, into the n by n matrices over the complex numbers. So supposing you have a homomorphism from these things into the matrices. This is commutative. Continuous functions on x. I didn't want to just work with manifolds, so I went from the C-infinity things to the continuous. That's all right in what I'm about to say now.
What are the algebraic homomorphisms?
Homomorphisms of algebras. I mean, they respect multiplication. So all I've done going from here to here is replace the complex numbers by the n by n matrices. What is the point of this space? Well, this is a commutative algebra, so such a homomorphism can be diagonalized. So if you diagonalize it, you then get n homomorphisms into the complex numbers along the diagonal. So in other words, you get capital N points of x. However, you get a bit more information because there was the choice of diagonalization. So what this space is, which I call spec nx, it's something which maps to the n-fold symmetric product, x to the n divided by the nth symmetric group, of course, by just taking the eigenvalues. But it has more information in that for each of these points in the interval, we can keep track of the eigenspace inside here. So we have points labeled not just with positive integer multiplicities, but with finite dimensional vector spaces, the eigenspaces. So we have this space, which I'll call this would be the one of size n. We again want to stabilize as n tends to infinity, and we'd also really like to introduce virtual ones where we allowed negative things, but I won't say any more about that just now because I want to stop. It's a horrible, horrible space. It's like f of x is already a horrible space. So I've introduced this thing that I call spec x non-commutative. And what I'm going to explain... The homomorphisms there were the points of x. The homomorphisms there are interpols decorated with some additional information about the eigenspaces. Let's call that space spec n of x. And let's call spec non-commutative some kind of limit, which I'm not going to be precise about as n tends to infinity, of spec n. So this is something which maps to f of x by just keeping track of what the eigenfunctions were, the eigenvalues, without remembering the spaces. I'm going to explain that this maps to vect virtual of xc. And I'm going to tell you about these spaces, both a little bit commutatively and a little bit non-commutatively. But what I want to say that at least in the situation that Robert Dycroft was talking about this morning, this space is the space of closed string states in X, and this space is the space where you put in the brains. Right? This, for instance, the connected components of this space are the K-theory of X, and so, for instance, if we take the cohomology of this, we'll get a direct sum of things indexed by the K-theory of X, so at least we're kind of in the right ballpark for the picture Robert was explaining. Anyway, that's the end of today's lecture. Ask any questions.
So again, this question is back about the origin of the
manifold.
You say it's not a manifold, I think.
No.
Although two parameters like this
space. But the symmetric product's not a manifold.
Right.
Symmetric product's not a manifold. See, it has bad singular. Right, this will be about as bad as a symmetric product. In fact, in some ways, might be slightly better because it's slightly resolved, but not. Let's consider points separate. Let's suppose we have capital N distinct points.
Yes.
Then we'd have a product of CP infinities above each point, because you see we would have a one-dimensional eigenspace which would be a line in a large vector space, the space on which the matrices were based. So if we considered capital N separated points, the additional data I'm giving at each point is a line in infinite dimensional space. So if I considered separated points, it's worth saying that certainly rationally, it doesn't matter whether you stay away from separated ones or not. That's the space of homotopy equivalent to the space of n small strings in X. Why is that? What do I mean by a small string? Supposing X is some manifold, and I pick a small number of epsilons such that any disk of radius epsilon is contractible, and supposing you consider the space of strings which fit inside an epsilon ball. What's the homotopy type of that? Well, you see, if you fix a point of X and look at strings inside that little ball, you're looking at maps of the circle into something contractible, but it has a free action of the diffeomorphism group of the circle, which you should divide by. So you have the homotopy type of CP infinity. So one small string looks like X plus CP infinity, the homotopy type of that. And n small strings looks exactly like this space. At least that's certainly an equivalence rationally. Whether it should be an equivalence integrally is, in a sense, this question of whether we want our brains and things to be K-theory or homological. Anyway, I'll say more about that. That's meant to be for tomorrow.
Yeah, that's going to be embarrassing, isn't it?